Well, good morning, everyone. We're coming to the final chapters in the book of Judges. We have today we'll be talking about 17 and 18, the tribe of Dan and Micah or Micaiu, sometimes as you'll see it rendered. Micah?
Micah.
Micah. Oh, there's a okay. I should have looked it up in Greek because it would give me the ch. Well, it's the same in Greek. Micha. If it's a key, you have to put a little phlegm into key, right? So, and then next week the Levite and his concubine, that will bring us to the end of Judges. Next week, by way of reminder, we won't is conferences. So we won't be meeting. Yours truly will be tied up all day talking to parents. After that, though, so the meeting after that, we'll finish the book of Judges. Mrs. Cummins just made the announcement for those of you who just came late to that you want to leave small group a little early because that's when you're going to have your picture. You know, wear your colorful clothes. And then we'll have two sessions on the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth takes place chronologically at the beginning of the history of the book of Judges. So this takes place at the same time. And one of the questions I just got before we started was, how far off is the king? How far off is Saul? You have to remind me, Ruth and Boaz, they are David's, is it grandparents or great-grandparents? Yeah, I want to say grandparents, but I'm always worried that I'm missing one. So, in any event, so we're two or three generations off from the time of Saul. I wanted to open as I could. As you see, I have the map up here because I think there are things about the narrative where the map becomes very helpful in terms of understanding what's happening. Before I jump into that, though, I want to share some general comments from some of the commentaries I've been reading. First from the Anglican commentary on the book of Judges. This is one carried out by Frederick Cook. It's online at Google Books. So many good things there are now public domain. This is what he says. Though placed at the end of the book, the two histories, that is of Micaiu and of the concubine and the Benjamite War, they manifestly belong chronologically to the beginning of it, as Josephus places them. Remember, Josephus has his version of Jewish history, and so he will take things and arrange them chronologically, which are not chronologically arranged in the Bible itself. Okay, they belong to the lifetime of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the grandson of Aaron. That of Ruth in like manner belongs to the age of the sons of the first settlers, Boaz being the son of Salmon and Rahab. How it's interesting to observe how the fullest details of the civil and domestic affairs of the Israelites belong to the age immediately after the Exodus, while the influence of Egyptian civilization and letters still remained, while the learning of Moses still lingered as it was among the peoples. So remember, what you're hearing now in these final chapters, this is almost immediately after the time that Joshua has passed on. And it gives you a sense of how quickly things are unraveling after Joshua dies. Remember earlier that when I sketched out from Lillian Klein the way that Judges is arranged. Judges is arranged not chronologically, but as it were by tribe. So it starts with Joshua's tribe. It starts with the tribe of Judah and then Benjamin. You start with these people who are closer, as it were, to the will of God and living it out more. And it ends with the tribe of Dan, who are the first ones to set up an idol and therefore pervert the religion of the people around them. Okay? So that's why it doesn't follow a chronology. You're being run, as it were, from the tribes who are, as it were, closest to God, to the tribes that are, to the tribes that are out there, and that's how we end. Okay, it's a very interesting topic just on its own. When you arrange narrative material, how do you arrange it? You know, for us, our reflex is just that you give it in chronological order. Oh, always. And but when you read great authors don't do that. They don't always arrange things chronologically. I've given already the example of the Death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy. It was fresh on my mind because the juniors read it. One of the things I'm reminded of is Pride and Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice, you're sort of put in the middle of the Bennet girls and the sort of trials they have about being able to marry and so on. And it's about in the middle of the book, and really through the eyes of Elizabeth, that we first hear of how is it that Mr. and Mrs. Bennet married and came to be the kind of couple they were. And it's in the middle of the book that you realize that Mr. Bennet basically married this woman because she was kind of good looking and fun. And she really didn't have a lot going on upstairs, but he didn't care about that then. And then once, you know, the marriage took place and they actually had kids and he realized that that mattered, he basically just retreated. I can't do anything to help my wife, so I'm just going to sit in the library and read. Okay? And it's put in the middle of the book because it's put closer to the moment of crisis, right? Where, is it Lydia? Isn't Lydia the one who runs away? I'm trying to remember. Yeah, Kitty is the one who's at home, but Lydia, I think, is the one who runs away. And it's at that moment that... in fact, it's a beautiful moment in the book. I realize, when you first read that book, you get caught up in the kind of romance and relationship elements of it. But one of the things that's going on in that book that seems to me is almost more important than that is Mr. Bennet's realization of his failure as a father. That it hits him for the first time that I have failed as a father. That this is happening because I refuse to actively involve myself in my daughter's upbringing. And so the description of how this couple came to be married, which is Elizabeth is kind of seeing for herself or realizing for herself, is put closer to the moment where the kind of seeds in the early part of that marriage, the seeds of trouble, as it were, blossom. When this daughter simply goes wild. Because remember, with Jane and Elizabeth, in a way, they have grown up into good people in spite of their parents, not because of their parents. They've grown up into good people in spite of their parents. Whereas Kitty and Lydia are more like mom. They're more like, and they could be better if their father could trouble himself, and he doesn't. Okay? So how do you arrange narrative material? Do you automatically, but you know, I was born a poor black child in a log cabin, right? You just start from there and just move forward. No, there can be things thematically, there can be things in terms of rhetorical points that you're making that direct you to arrange material differently. And you always have to have an eye for that in scripture. You know, Luke is the only one of the Gospels where he says, I am telling you this in order. But Matthew does not. Matthew is not arranging things in a chronological order. In fact, if you follow Matthew, things tend to be bunched around Jesus' discourses. So there'll be action, but action always surrounds some kind of discourse that Jesus is making. And certainly in John, that is not arranged chronologically. There are, again, theological points that John wants to make where he will connect related events, not because they happened right near each other, but because these events in some way illuminate each other or make it helpful to understand. Again, when you look at John, remember there'll be an event like the healing of the man born blind and then a kind of a discourse that follows it. And there are some commentators who have taken the whole of John and shown that there's a kind of a ring structure to it, where, in other words, things at the beginning are mirrored by things at the end, and then there are things which occur kind of in the next level, which are mirrored by things that happen, you know, sort of the next level over, and so on. It forms this kind of ring structure, which builds to a kind of a central point. One of the great injustices, I think, that's done against Scripture is really to just think of it as a pastiche of texts that have just been thrown together in a kind of a hodgepodge by a clueless editor who just didn't know how to arrange his material. Scripture scholars who say that should be sued for slander. You get a lot more out of the book if you really assume that each of these things is an artistic creation, that things are arranged the way they are for a reason, for some kind of intent. And that if you're not seeing the intent, or you think it's thrown together, the problem is you. The problem isn't the author. So let's take a look at our geography here and have that give us a better sense of what's happening. Before I do, one more text. Robert Alter, from his wonderful book on ancient Israel. Robert Alter writing directly, as is his custom. Anarchy and lust link these stories directly with the Samson narrative. But the theme of violence threatened in Micha's story, shockingly realized in the narrative that follows, ties in the concluding chapters of Judges with everything that precedes them in the book. Judges represents, one might say, the Wild West era of the biblical story. Men are a law unto themselves. Against this background, one can begin to see the line of imagistic and thematic continuity with the maiming of Adonai Bezek at the very beginning of the book to the dismembering of the concubine at the end. Okay? So again, things that happen right at the beginning are connected with the things that happen, you know, at the very end. So let's remind ourselves about geography here. This is the southern part of the Promised Land, and we'll work our way up. When you see Dan labeled there, that's what they were supposed to get. Now, it involved more work than they wanted to put into it. Okay, so you're getting in this narrative how it is that they end up going north. I'll show you where in just a bit, and they're going to find something that's not so hard. Okay. These cities right here, Ascalon, Ashdod, and so on, this is where the Philistines were. So when you're seeing these conflicts between Samson and the Philistines, this is happening, it's happening here, or happening right here. Remember at one point when Samson, I think this is after the prostitute that he visits and he drags away the gates, who is it that complains? It's not the people of Dan who complain, is it? Because they're not around anymore. It's the people of Judah who complain. Right? These are the ones who are neighbors to the Philistines. It's interesting. His own tribe isn't complaining. Because there aren't really a lot of them around to complain anymore. So that's when he cuts this deal with them. Okay, tie me up and make it look like the bonds are really tight. And hand me over. Just don't do anything yourself. And so that's when he sheds his bonds and beats up a lot of the Philistines again. What fun. Okay? So the action of Samson involves a guy who's kind of not where he belongs. Okay? And that's what's emphasized in the rest of the narrative. You keep having people where they don't belong. Okay? So in the story, for example, with Micah, we've got this Levite who apparently is from Judah, but it's not clear exactly where he belongs, but he certainly doesn't belong in Micah's house. Okay? And in fact, remember, that's when the Danites get the idea, hey, let's take this guy, right? They're staying with Micah. Micah's a nice host to them. And as they're leaving, they hear this guy talking, and I don't know what it is. It's that Judah twang or something. He's just got that accent that, hey, wait a minute. You know, that's when they get the idea, hey, let's take this guy too. He doesn't belong here. Okay? So the tribe of Dan, right next to Ephraim here, this is kind of where they start out. Their job is to conquer this, but instead what they do is they send spies and they start looking for a place 100 miles to the north. So the town that you hear about, Lachish, which they end up taking, that's up there with that dot that's labeled Dan. Okay, so imagine this big road, you know, one of those big, you know, town labeling signs. It has Lackish on it, and then it's been spray painted over it, Dan. Okay, so that's the place that they take over. And in fact, the very language of it is almost a kind of parody of what happened earlier with in Exodus and Numbers. Remember that Moses sends out spies, and the spies come back and they say, this is a great land, but the people here, they are bad. You know, these are tough guys. They make us look like grasshoppers. You know, they're big guys. It's threatening, and there are even some of the spies that say, "Oh, it's kind of harsh. You don't want to live there." No. These spies come back and they report the exact opposite kind of thing, don't they? This is a great and prosperous land, and these guys are pushovers. And we can walk through them like partridges. You know, essentially, that's the message they give. So as opposed to finding a territory, as you hear about Numbers, where there's some kind of great gift there, but there's some kind of challenge, now God is going to work with them to overcome that challenge. No, they want something nice and cush that doesn't demand too much effort, and they can do all of them all by themselves. Okay? So the spies report back, this is a fertile country. These guys don't even have walls. You know, this is going to be a pushover. So that's where Dan ends up. And so that's why proverbially, when you talk about the Holy Land, you'll get this expression from Dan to Gaza or Dan to Judah, because Dan ends up being the northernmost point. That's not where God put them, right? And maybe one way to think about this book, especially as we come to the end of this book, are you where God has appointed you to be? Right? Sometimes when I think about these chapters and, you know, where people belong, there's a documentary that I show to juniors every year, which is A Life of Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And at one point they're interviewing her, and she says, the most important thing in the Christian life is that you are following God's will. So that if God puts you on the streets and he puts you in the gutter, that you're able to say, this is God's will, and you're able to live in the gutter. If God puts you in a palace, that you're able to live in a palace. But not that you're living in the palace because you want to live in the palace, but that you're living in the palace because you recognize this is God's will. Okay? That wherever it is you're put, wherever it is you're placed, that you can discern that that's part of God's will, that you can do what it is that is expected of you, that you can do what it is that you're called to do in that place. And these tribal allotments, this was God's will. I am creating a place for you. I'm designating a place for you. That doesn't mean you're just going to walk into it and it's easy. You are going to have difficulties to overcome in winning that place, but I will be with you. And the attitude that you're seeing, especially with the tribe of Dan, is, no, I don't want the place you're putting me in because I don't want the difficulties. I am going to follow my own way. I'm going to take the path of least resistance. I'm going to move myself to the place that's easy and unchallenging, and be content with that. And a kind of sign of that is that they bring their own priest, BYOP, okay? They bring their own BYOL, they bring their own Levite. They steal Mikhail's household gods. Hey, we need some gods, right? They steal his gods. And they essentially set up their own religious center and their own form of worship and their own priest. This is a sort of a glaring example of them trying to make themselves sufficient to themselves. And I know a lot of times we speak about following our own will, our own desires, as being a kind of an idolatry, right? That you make your own pleasure or money or fame or status or, you know, whatever it is, that that's what's first in your life, that that becomes kind of an idol. But here what you see in with this tribe of Dan is that it literally is a kind of idol. There is literally an idol that, as it were, they bring with them. And it sort of emphasizes they've made themselves their own rulers. They really are breaking apart from God's governance. They want to be able to live as they wish on their own terms. They don't want to have to follow. And of course, this isn't just like these bad guys. I mean, obviously, if we, that is the inclination that all of us are, to which we are inclined. We would rather have our own way, which we see to be an easier way, than to submit to God's will, which always involves difficulties that we cannot overcome by our own power. Right? Unless in some way, in other words, we're able to see ourselves in that tribe of Dan, we're not going to get out of this what we need to get out of it. That all of us, in some way, shape, or form, are not inclined to what to the good that God wants to give, precisely because the difficulties are daunting. And the difficulties require that there is a dependence and a submission to God's will. Submission is never enjoyable. I suppose it can be, but you're pretty far along in the spiritual path at the point it becomes enjoyable, you know. So at this point, I have some notes to refer to. Some of these I've started talking about already, but probably have to spend a little more time talking about Micha. I've mentioned already, I have up there ending with the beginning, that this book ends with events that chronologically are there at the start, and why it is that it starts that way. That this is a book of, in other words, of decline. So it starts with the tribes that are more or less following. More or less following the will of God. The tribes that just flat out aren't. And you also have this emphasis in these last four chapters. There was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. You hear that first in the chapter we look at, 17, verse 6. It's the very first line in chapter 18. And then in 19, it's the very first line of 19. And then, is that 21, 25? Is that right? No, that should be, 21, 25. That's how Judges ends. It's the very last line of Judges. So, and plainly the idea here is that what a king would do is in some way enforce the will of God, in some way direct the chosen people to the will of God. Remember that at the beginning of the Gospels, the coming of the Messiah is the coming of the king. And that somehow what you have in David and Solomon and others is an image of what's to come. And plainly, with David, with Saul and David and Solomon, an imperfect image, a flawed image, but nonetheless the beginning of understanding what God's kingdom would be. Because remember, the gospel is all about the coming of the kingdom. So unless you're able to understand that the king signifies something important for the chosen people, you know, for all of us, then I don't think these words resonate the way they need to. I mean, ultimately, when we see there was no king and every man did what was right in his own eyes, ultimately, looking forward, what we have to think is, you know, the Lord Jesus, the true king. That is what is going to assist. You know, in fact, that is what's going to allow the people of God, allow those of us who have been brought into this kingdom, not to just do what's right in our own eyes. It's not just that we have someone, as it were, telling us what to do, but somebody who's going to be working from the inside. You know, that's the significance of phrases like, the kingdom of God is within you. That it is a spiritual power that you are being given. Okay? But now, looking back, as it were, from their point of view, there is no kind of central authority directing men toward God's will. And that's ideally what a king would do. And the problem, of course, for them is a king always seems to be, as it were, in competition with God. Right? Remember what in Samuel, when the people ask for a king, they're not asking, hey, can we have a king so that we are able more fully to follow God's will and plan for us? Right? Remember, their complaint is, hey, can't we have a king like the nations to lead us in the battle? You know, in other words, they want a king as they understand a king. And God, on the other hand, is, you know, he wants them to have a king for a very different reason than they're asking for one. Again, how commonly it is that there are things that we ask for from God that he doesn't actually answer our prayer. Certainly he doesn't answer it the way we ask it. Why? Because he loves us. Right? He doesn't just give you what you ask for. That's the difference, perhaps, between, you know, magic and grace. Right? With magic, you get what you're asking for, but what you're asking for turns out not to be for your good. So if you're familiar with this story, my favorite example of this, the monkey's paw. If you're familiar with that story by W.W. Jacobs, where you have this couple and there's a stranger and they get this kind of mummified monkey's paw. This guy tells them, this traveler tells them that it has these magical powers that you make wishes and it gives them to you. So they wish for 100 pounds. See if we can get 100 pounds out of this. And so what happens? They make this wish and then about a half hour later there's a knock at the door. It's folks from the factory where their son works. I'm very sorry to tell you this. Your son died in a terrible machine accident, but he had an insurance policy on his life. We insure all our employees. Here's your 100 pounds. Yeah. If you've never read The Monkey Spot, it's a short story. But what it shows you is the difference between grace and magic. Magic, as it were, gives you what you ask for, but it's to your harm. Whereas the idea of grace is that when God assists you supernaturally, he may not give it to you in the form that you asked for it, but that's because he's giving it to you for your good. Okay? He's giving it to you for your good. I believe there's a country song which has something about thank heavens for unanswered prayers. Yeah, Garth Brooks, very good. And that's the idea. There may be all sorts of things that you prayed for in your younger life that now you are exceedingly grateful that God did not only answer that. Well, he answered those prayers by saying no. And there would not be a loving God, in fact, if he gave you those things, half of those things that you asked for. Go ahead, Karen.
I'm seeing the story of the mom in the New Testament. And he goes, so Jesus, which side will my son sit?
Yeah, this is the son of James and John, right? Yeah. The sons of thunder.
Are they going to sit at your right hand or your left?
Yes.
And then Jesus says, you don't even know what you're asking for.
Yeah, but notice that he turns to the boys. Are you sure you want this? We do, right? Okay. And then he does a kind of a bait and switch on them. Well, you will drink from the cup that I'm going to drink, but, you know, sit on my right hand and my left. It's not mine to give. So they appear to get the hard part, but not the, not the cushy part. But again, because they're asking, as it were, from a motive of, getting in and promotion and being in charge. And Jesus simply makes it clear to them that, the thing that's going to allow you to really be my disciple is your willingness to suffer. You know, think about what, in fact, what God says to, is it Ananias? The fellow who acts as kind of the tutor for Paul when he first comes into the church. I'm blanking on this guy's name. But, I'm sorry? Yeah, I'm blanking it too. But that he says, see how much my servant Paul will suffer for my sake. You know, and it's true, he does. He has that whole list of sufferings. Scourgings and shipwrecks and perils at sea and perils on land, but he undergoes that, out of love for the gospel. Okay, but that's what's going to characterize. Whenever I try to help students understand the difference between Islam and Christianity, right? I just want to give them a kind of a brief, not necessarily scholarly contrast. The first 300 years of Christianity is the spreading of a religion by preaching and miracles, and in which those who follow it and those who convert to it are persecuted. Okay, so the first 300 years is people being brought into this religion that's largely a persecuted religion. The first 300 years of Islam is a spreading of a religion by violence. This is the spreading of a religion by violence. And it's that way from the very beginning. It's that way from Muhammad leading an army into Mecca. Okay, and then the conquest of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and the conquest of North Africa and Spain. And if it hadn't been for Charles Martel at Tours, it would have been the whole of Europe. Okay, so whatever you want to say about history after that in terms of, barbarian kings who did forced conversions, or the conquistadors, or whatnot. Whatever you want to say in terms of things that seem to go against that principle in Christianity, simply compare the first 300 years, right, where you have the influence of the leader at its strongest. What characterizes Christianity is people embracing this faith when violence is done to them. What you have for the first 300 years of Islam is people spreading a faith by inflicting violence on the people before them for all of North Africa and all the Middle East. Go ahead.
I just have a quick question, and it's kind of on this topic, maybe changing, but can you say God bless you to a Muslim? Can it, like when you're leaving or if you meet someone, can you say God bless you?
Let me say this, and it might answer your question. I'm not sure that will, but I guess I would say this. I have had students ask me, don't we believe in the same God? And I will tell them, no. And by the way, ask a Muslim that. No Muslim is God. It's only dreamy, ecumenical, interfaith Christians that talk about we all worship the same God. Orthodox Muslims don't say that. Why? Because the very name Allah, Allah yala Allah, the one who is one, the very name emphasizes the unity of God against this, they believe, heretical teaching that somehow there are three persons in God, which they consider to be polytheism. Okay? So the idea that somehow we are worshiping the same God, you have to make a number of qualifications for that to be reasonable. You know, it's only with a number of qualifications that would be a reasonable thing to say. Generally, you'd have to say, simply speaking, no, we don't worship the same God, because they believe in a God who is, again, one, not a Trinity, and they think the Trinity is false and heretical. Further, their idea of God is a master. Okay, the very word Islam means submission. It's all about submission. Whereas you believe in a God who is ultimately a God of love, a God who takes on a human nature, suffers, dies, and saves the human race and brings them into adoption, right? That you are adopted children of God. In Islam, there is no idea of being an adopted child of God. You are always a servant or slave. God is a master, you are slaves. Okay? So, to my mind, the people who want to equate the Muslim God and the Christian God, they're like these people in C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle, who want to say that Aslan and Tash, right, this God of the Calormenes, who's kind of like this vulture God. You remember at one point in that book, these Narnians who are running this kind of con game, they will talk about Tashlan, right, that Aslan and Tash are really different aspects of the same God. And I'm very grateful that C.S. Lewis did that, because I know a number of kids that they'll go to a school where they kind of teach that Allah and God are the same thing. And you'll have these kids, they've grown up with C.S. Lewis, and they kind of go back to mom and dad and say, you know what? I heard about Tashlan today, right? They recognize that what they're being told is essentially this fraud. And because they've been formed in C.S. Lewis, they can recognize it as a fraud. But generally, it's only kind of dopey Christians who think that they're the same thing. Muslims, don't fall for that.
I said it out of habit. I said that to a girl that I had met getting coffee, and she was one of nine, and were talking about big families. I said, well, God bless you. And she looked at me with these eyes like that were this.
Saucers.
No one had ever said that to her before, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know what was going on in the reaction or,
yeah.
But you just have to be. I mean, you can wish for God to bless a Muslim, but for God to bless a Muslim means that He's going to lead them out of Islam.
Yeah.
that's the blessing of the blessing we have to give is that He's going to lead. If remember, in general, with other religions, people are not saved by them. They can be saved in them. They can be saved in spite of them, but they're not saved because of them. In other words, it would have to be because there are at least some truths in Islam that are salvific. You know, that there is a God, that He is merciful, right? Those kind of things could be salvific. But in some way, they'd have to, at some level, reject some of the things that come from their own religion. You know, in other words, you could be saved kind of as a heretical Muslim, not as an Orthodox one. However strange that may sound to you. go ahead.
I was watching the news yesterday when they had the videotape of the man in New York.
Yes,
and
which I haven't seen, but go ahead.
Okay, but he says, I don't know what the words are, that he says, Allah Akbar.
God is great. Allah Akbar. God is great.
So how does that translate to God is great? Why?
Because God is powerful. God is smiting the unbelievers.
But why aren't we saying Allah is great? Why are we saying God is great as a translation? I'm just confused.
Oh.
Oh, why do we keep it?
Allah is great.
Does that make sense?
Because they're not. Remember, I mean, I guess the easiest way to answer your question, this is being reported by journalists who don't reflect on religion at all.
Yeah. That's my point, because then if I go to Google it and say, what were those words? I can find what the journalists have put in.
Yeah, probably all you know this, but remember, when you're talking about journalists know next to nothing about religion. They're not religious themselves. Generally, they don't even know people who are religious. So religion continues to be something that's baffling for them. And if you think this is just, you know, my, you know, like personal point of view as a religion teacher, read someone like Jonathan Allen, who is a Catholic journalist. He writes for the National Catholic Reporter, which is kind of on the progressive end of the, but is a wonderfully objective journalist. But he will give whole lectures on just the general ignorance that there is among journalists about religion. He reports on the Vatican, he reports on the American church, and he says, you know, American journalists and European journalists too, they don't even have a kind of like a desk reference knowledge of religion which would allow them to, you know, address with any kind of accuracy what they talk about. So there's no mystery that people report things on religion and it's just a mishmash because they just don't know. Right, you have to remember a lot of these people, all they did was major in journalism.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't know a lot besides that. You know, it's hard to sometimes wrap your mind around. Yeah, go ahead.
Mike was discussing, getting back to the reading, if maybe Mike and his mom might have been Delilah or maybe the grandson of Delilah because they mentioned the 1,100 pieces of silver.
Yeah, and I don't think it's because it's Delilah. I think it's thematic. In other words, the numbers the same because in God's providence, He wants to connect these events. So it's not, in other words, it's not like there's this one account of 1,100 silver pieces that's, you know, and it sort of gives you away who it is. It's, you know, it's like the 30 pieces of silver, you know, that occurs as an actual amount for someone is betrayed in the Old Testament, and then it becomes, right, a prophecy, and then it becomes this same amount which Jesus is betrayed with. Okay? So, no, it's not that it's the same 1,100, but you're right. You're meant to connect these two things because Delilah, she's someone who's essentially willing to betray, you know, Samson for money. Then when you come to Micah's mom, is somebody who's been squirreling away this money and squirreling away, and And clearly it's something that's really, that's what's important to her. You know, son tries to embezzle it. How does he get discovered? Because mom calls down the judgment of God on whoever is, you know, taking this money, the curse of God. That is a way, shows you where her religion is. When does she call upon God? When her money's gone. Okay? It's like the event of, if you've ever read Don Quixote, there's this, it's a very long book, but there's this episode where Sancho Panza, who's, you know, Don Quixote's kind of squire, he becomes the governor of an island. And I forget how this comes about, but anyway, they have all these little stories which show the wisdom of his judgment. There's a point where this man and this woman come in, and she claims, he assaulted me, he raped me, he took my innocence. And so he says, well, you man, you have to, you know, pay her a fine. Give her 40 pieces of gold. And he does. And she leaves, and then he keeps the guy for a while and says, okay, that 40 pieces of gold, go take it from her. So, okay, so he runs out, and he tries, and he can't. He can't get it. She's holding on to it and kicking and biting and screaming. His guards bring him back in, and Sancho Panza says, how is it that your virtue was easier to take than the gold? Okay? So for Mika's mom, right, she will call down the curse of God. That's now Mika feels threatened. He comes clean. He gives her the money back. And what does she do? She celebrates by taking a big chunk of it and making an idol out of it. Or, you know, essentially dedicating an idol. And by the way, and in this amount, when this priest is taken on, what's his salary? Yeah, 10. So they've got like 1,100 gold, you know, 1,100 gold pieces, and he's got this like 10 or silver pieces. He's got this 10 silver piece salary. So again, it shows you by contrast what are the priorities of these people. Okay, and remember what comes out of this. This wealth is not just an idol, right? They've got like four different kinds of religious things here. Two of which are oracular. You know, they're like the Urim and the Thurim, these things that are kind of like lots. Maybe the way we would think about the easiest example, here I am giving away my upbringing in the 70s. Like that eight ball that you'd shake with the water, right? Yes, no, answer unclear, yeah. So essentially they've got those kinds of things. And again, these are all ways, why are those things related there? They're all ways of having divinity or having the divine on your own terms. They're always of having the divinity, having God on your own terms. Okay? That you've got, as it were, these little household gods, or you've got these little household sources to the supernatural. You don't need to rely on God and God's will or visions or dreams. You kind of have your own thing so that you don't have to have that. Go ahead. Explain what you mean.
Well, when Jephthah came back from battle and he said
that it comes out.
Well, remember, that's not a curse. That's a vow. That's a vow. And, you know, you help me win this battle. I will sacrifice the first person that comes out of my house.
Okay.
Yeah. And
it's not really considered a curse.
No. That's a vow. Because remember that he's fighting against people that's what they do. They solicit their own gods and appease their own gods by human sacrifice. So he thinks, well, hey, I'm not going to be outdone, right? I'll sacrifice somebody too if that's what it takes. So God gives him the victory, but then if you like, he punishes him by having him, by putting up with him or not stopping him from sacrificing his own daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you can imagine this woman. She just gets worked up about this money, calls down the judgment of God, and once it's her own son. Yeah, 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 take that back. Go ahead, Mrs. Bettina.
I don't think you got all the he was cursed. So.
Yeah.
He didn't die, but no.
No, but he loses his Levite. He loses his idols. You know. Yeah. All these things that he had kind of built up with the money. He, in other words, expected to have kind of his own gods and his own religion and his own thing. And he gets robbed by these Danites who they take all that stuff up north, and now they got their own thing going on. Okay? So next time we will... in fact, I think I shared with you when I introduced the book years ago, 60 Minutes, they were running a piece on censorship. And they get this evangelical preacher on, and they read to him this episode of The Concubine from Judges. And whoever it was, Morley Safer, whoever it was, closes the book. How can you be in favor of censorship when you have stuff like this in your own book? Okay? So if you're going to pick a narrative from the Bible to kind of, get at somebody about, the bad things that they talk about in this book. Boom. That's one of the narratives you're going to fasten on. So, we will talk about that next time. So not this week. Week from today is conferences. The week after, that's when we'll be meeting. 15th. Very good. Thank you.